From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio. Science and technology that is accessible and entertaining. And if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Katie Mullally, and today we speak first with one of the leading mycologists in the world. Mycology? It's the study of fungi. Or is it fungi? Well, however you call it, Bryn Dentinger from the University of Utah and Natural History Museum of Utah explores the wild world of fungi with us. Then we talk about potential life outside of this planet with science writer and essayist Jamie Green, who traces the history of our understanding from the days of Galileo and Copernicus to our contemporary quest for exoplanets and alien life. Along the way, she weaves insights from science fiction writers who construct worlds that in turn inspire scientists. Her new book is The Possibility of Life: Science, Imagination, and Our Quest for Kinship in the Cosmos. These guests, when we return, stay with us.
Welcome to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Katie Mullally.
Now imagine yourself in a casual conversation at, say, a cocktail party, and someone asks you what you do for a living, and you say, I'm a curator of mycology. Well, enter our next guest who has that curious distinction. Dr. Bryn Dentinger is the curator of mycology at the Natural History Museum of Utah. Now, mycology, of course, is the study of fungus or fungi, or is it fungi? And how does one go about curating it? We're about to learn. Bryn is also an associate professor at the Natural History Museum of Utah and the biology department, the University of Utah, and he travels the world. We're catching up with him in the early morning hours of tomorrow, I think, in Australia, where he is doing research. Bryn, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Hi, thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
Well, it's really fun to have you on, and we really have never spoken to a curator of mycology before. I just think that's like the best title anyone could ever have.
There aren't many of us, so I'm not surprised.
Now, you hail from Minnesota, and I'm wondering how you got interested in the study of, and do you say fungi or fungi? How do you pronounce it?
The one you haven't said yet, which is fungi. Yeah, I got interested at an early age. I was in high school. I grew up in a family that spent a lot of time outdoors, fishing, hunting, camping. And so I was already predisposed, I guess, to looking at nature. And I just kind of got interested in mushrooms because they were sort of mysterious to me and still are. And they just are fascinating. Once you look at them really closely, they have a lot of beauty and complexity to them that I just find endlessly fascinating.
Not only beauty and complexity, but healing properties and part of a really important part of ecosystems. And I think they're also very mysterious to all of us. I think, and maybe you would agree with this, that there's so much that the average person doesn't know about. Oh, now I'm really caught. I'm hung up on the words. Fungi is how you pronounce it.
Fungi. If you were in Europe, fungi would be perfectly fine.
Okay. What are the things that surprise you most that we don't know, the average layperson, about mushrooms, let's say?
Oh, there's way too much. I'd fill up all of our time here if I started to list off all the things that I find fascinating that people don't know. But it's the least known of the major eukaryotic lineages. So if you think of plants and animals, this is the equivalent of a plant or an animal, but it's a completely independent lineage. It originated 1.5 billion years ago when it diverged from the common ancestor with animals. So we're actually close cousins with the fungi. And it's really fascinating to see how evolution has played out in a completely different way from a common origin. I like to think of the fungi as sort of like inverted stomachs. It's like our ancestor took two paths, one where the stomach or the way that you get your nutrition is internalized, and the other where you get your nutrition from outside. And so if you just invert our stomachs, that's what a fungus is. And they excrete enzymes into their environment. So they live in their food, and those enzymes, you like your stomach enzymes, break down what's outside of them, and then they reabsorb the nutrients. So this is what life looks like when you take a different path. And as you said, yes, they are incredibly important ecologically. They allowed colonization of land, actually, 450 odd million years ago. So without the fungi, plants never could have adapted to the terrestrial habit given their toolkit, their genetic toolkit. And that's because plants require a lot of water and they can't really access that water efficiently, especially if you start out as an aquatic plant. You need a lot of water and there's no water on land essentially. And so it was the fungi on the roots of those plants that were able to access enough water for them to survive on land. And that's how land got colonized. So if that event never happened, none of us would be here. We wouldn't be talking right now. So that's kind of an amazing thing to think about that most people just don't know because we don't educate people on fungi. Like I said, they're the least known of the major groups. And that's because there are few people like me out there, right? Few people that know about them and even fewer that teach about them. I didn't have access to a mycology course until I was in graduate school. Even then, I never took mycology per se. It was a small 4-person seminar. You know, it wasn't a big class that you get introduced to the fungi. So, yeah, I'm just kind of going on and on here. Maybe we should move on.
Well, if you're just joining us, we're talking with Bryn Dentinger, curator of mycology at the Natural History Museum and associate professor of biology with the University of Utah. So, Bryn, we think of fungi as mostly mushrooms. That's what we see. That's what we associate the title with. What else is considered a fungi?
Yeah, so fungi encompass a wide variety of different habits and life forms. So the mushrooms really are a small percentage of them. There's about 25,000 species of mushroom forming fungi. And I'll take a moment to explain here that mushrooms are just the reproductive structures of a fungus. So it's sort of equivalent to a flower or a fruit. So the body of the fungus is unseen. It's growing in the soil or in the wood or wherever it happens to be. And that mushroom is just a small part of it. So the other fungi that are abundant, extremely abundant, are lichens, especially in Utah. We see a lot of lichens. In fact, lichens cover something like 1/5 of the Earth's surface. They're incredibly successful symbiosis between a fungus and an alga. And then other forms would be molds and yeasts, and then some other things that you find on plants, plant pathogens like rusts and smuts and that kind of thing.
So what percentage of life on Earth is made up of fungi?
Oh, I don't have a statistic for that, unfortunately. It's a lot, way more than we know about, I'll say that. So we've only documented about 5 to 10% of the fungi, we think. There's probably somewhere around 10 million species of fungi. 5 to 10 million is sort of the estimate people come up with. It's just a ballpark estimate. But we've only documented 150,000 of them. So there's way more out there than we know about.
Bryn, I'm wondering for those people who study fungi like you, are you the same people that study the fungus among us, as that saying goes, the fungus that are internal in a human, or is that a completely different world?
So far, the mycobiome, as it's called, tends to be studied by people in more medically oriented fields. But there are mycologists that study the mycobiome as well. It's, again, of course, less known than the microbiome, that is the bacteria that live inside of us. But there are fungi that live in our bodies. Yeasts, in particular, are found in our intestinal tracts. And in fact, there's some emerging evidence that fungi are super important, both as sort of commensals in our body. They are involved in digestion and that kind of thing. But also they may be the source of some diseases, including cancer. So there's some emerging evidence that there's a variety of cancers that have very strong associations with fungal infections. In fact, one of them, pancreatic cancer, has been shown to more or less be caused by a fungus that gets embedded systemically. It's a fungus that normally grows on our skin, on our scalp, and is the cause of dandruff. It's called Malassezia. And when people get systemic infections of Malassezia, that can result in pancreatic cancer.
That is fascinating. I've never heard of that before. And yet it's interesting that the healing properties of mushrooms, for example, you know, we all ought to be eating a lot more mushrooms because they are so good for us. And so it's a little bit of a dichotomy or a contradiction in a way that we don't want yeast and fungus growing inside us, yet we want to ingest some from the outside. Can you explain that?
Well, I would say it's no different than with plants or animals. There are some poisonous plants that we wouldn't want in our bodies also. In fact, here there's quite a few of them in Australia. There's something called the stinging tree around here that is like it's a nettle. And if you brush it, and it'll cause you pain for months and months. So those are bad plants, right? And so there are bad fungi too, but there are also lots of good fungi out there. And as you say, there's a lot of fungi are really good to eat. They taste delicious, but they're also good for you. And they're an alternative source of protein, for example. So they are complete. They're a complete protein, just like animal proteins. But of course, it's not animal meat. We can grow it more efficiently. It's a lot more environmentally sustainable. And we have a lot more to explore there. Yeah, I'm fumbling a little bit because there's a lot of, it's very popular to talk about the medicinal qualities of mushrooms. But the reality is there's very little empirical data to support many of those claims. And so I'm just a little reluctant to jump into that.
So I'm fascinated with the fact that the mushrooms that we see are basically the flowering fruit, if you will, of the fungi. So what you're telling us is that these porcinis that we find in the Uintas aren't just there for our own tasty benefit, and they're just a fraction of the fungi that's below the surface. So what is that subsurface fungi actually doing as part of the ecosystem in the forest, say specifically like the Uintas?
Yeah, so there's a couple of major roles that fungi play in the soil. One is that they are the primary decomposers. So they are the first line of decomposition of dead organic material, converting that back into nutrients that support many future generations of plants and animals. So they're really critical for nutrient cycling in the Uintas especially. The other role they play, and this dominates the forest ecosystems in the Uintas, for example, is they form what are known as mycorrhizal relationships. That means fungus root, literally, mycorrhizal. And what they do is they live inside or outside, depending on the type of fungus, the roots of the plants, and they increase the surface area that the plants have access to in the soil. So if you think about very fine hairs emanating from the plant root, they're much smaller than a plant root can ever get. And that means that the surface that they have access to increases up to 4 times. And that's really critical to the survival of these plants. They all require it. It's something like 90% or 80%, depending on who you talk to, of all land plants require these mycorrhizal relationships to survive. And they depend on it for water acquisition, but also nutrient acquisition. And they pay for it in sugar. And up to 20-30% of the sugar that a plant makes through photosynthesis is used to pay a fungus for its services. So it's really, really important to our forested ecosystems in Utah.
So I've always wondered, when we've gone up to the Uintas and harvested, hopefully some years, buckets of porcinis, just, you know, cutting off the porcini at the base, are we harming that underground fungi system, or is there something we can do when we harvest the mushrooms to ensure the health of that underground system?
There's no evidence to suggest that it harms the fungus by picking the mushroom. People have tried to study it in different mushrooms, not porcini exactly, and there's no strong evidence that harvesting has any impact on the health of the fungus. So for porcini specifically, these are long-lived individuals. They're probably as old as the trees are, and they can cover large areas in the forest. And so when you're picking the mushroom, it's really just a very small part of the whole body of the fungus.
Bren, you're known as one of the foremost experts on the porcini mushroom in the world, really. And something that I didn't know was that porcinis are found all over the world. Is that right?
Yeah, they are. They're rare in the southern hemisphere. And in fact, the southernmost species of porcini is right here in Australia. And in fact, I collected it yesterday. I can show you, it's in my dryer.
Wow, that's great. So you are there in Australia doing what kind of research? What do you, I mean, I'm sure it's outside of the porcini, but maybe it includes it.
Yeah, I'm really focused on the porcini family. So that family is called the Bolitaceae. What we know about it is it's very diverse. It underwent what's known as an evolutionary radiation about 150 million years ago. You know, that's sort of like the birds or the orchids. If you think about like a lot of species that formed in a very short period of time, that's what happened with the porcini mushrooms. And so we're trying to understand that better. We're trying to understand how they're all related to one another, which we don't yet know, how diverse they are, but also primarily interested in understanding how those species came about, what drove that diversification. And so to do that, we really need a comprehensive view of the family. So that's why I'm here in Australia. I'm trying to fill in gaps in our sampling. In particular, we're targeting places like Australia because we think that very old ancient lineages that can tell us a lot about the origins still exist here. That's certainly true for the plants and animals. And so far, our evidence is suggesting that that's also true for the fungi.
So since fungi has such a valuable component to offer the soil and the ecosystem, you know, we've seen the little pellets you can plant for mushrooms, those usually go into trees. But is there something that we can do to enhance the fungi or add it to our own, let's say our backyard gardens or the hills behind us, to way to supplement that?
Really, it's just maintaining good health. So not putting pesticides and not putting fertilizer. Those are the kinds of things that will promote fungal growth. But they're pretty good at doing their own thing, actually. Many of them probably survived the impact of the asteroid better than most other life on the planet. They're probably the ones that will be here when we all extinguish. So I think it's just a matter of not harming them more than promoting them per se.
I'm still fascinated by the fact that fungi is its own its own thing. It's separate from plants, separate from animals. It's its own kingdom.
Yeah, the kingdom.
How far back can you trace that kingdom in the geologic record?
Well, there's not much of a geologic record for fungi, and that's because they're soft. They don't have hard calcified or chitinous large structures, although I will say they have cell walls like plants, and their cell wall is composed in part of chitin, and that's the same material you'll find on arthropod exoskeletons, or that crunchy stuff on your crab or your lobster tail, or on that spider that you just crushed in your house. That's chitin, and the fungi have that as well. So, but they don't leave a fossil record primarily. So the evidence we have comes from inferring shared ancestry. And we do know, say, from the animal lineage that they go back together. And that goes back to about 1.5 billion years ago. So they're quite old. There's some evidence coming out. There's actually some odd fossil evidence from deep in the ocean that suggests fungi may be even much older than that. But, you know, that fossil evidence is a little hard to interpret.
You know, you're in Australia, and obviously we spoke before we started this interview about this lush, beautiful background you have. But you do spend a lot of time, well, around the world, but you spend a lot of time here in Utah, the Natural History Museum of Utah, where, again, you are the curator of mycology. And I'm wondering what that looks like. Do you... You have a collection of fungi that you exhibit at the Natural History Museum?
Yeah, well, at present, there's nothing on display in the public spaces at the museum. I'm hoping to change that eventually. So right now, if you wanted to see our collection, you'd have to go behind the scenes. And we do have a behind the scenes event every year where you can come and view that collection. But it's just a weekend, unfortunately. And what that looks like is we have large metal cabinets, and in those cabinets on the shelves are boxes, and within the boxes are more boxes. And in those boxes are dried fungal specimens, almost exclusively mushrooms in my case, because those are the fungi that I specialize on. And so that's what we collect and store. So the way that we preserve them is we dry them using either low heat. So I use a food dehydrator when I have access to electricity, but sometimes I'm places where I don't have access to electricity, and then we can dry them with silica gel. And once the specimens are completely dried, they get put into sealable plastic bags, transported back to the museum, and then they will be carefully put into archival boxes wrapped in acid-free tissue paper to keep them from bouncing around, and then stored in those cabinets in a climate-controlled room. And that's what it looks like.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. So I know that you, as a researcher and a scientist, you are not doing the kind of research that maybe the lay person would be able to use. You know, it's a whole different world going out into the forest and identifying mushrooms to perhaps pick them, eat them. But does that, you know, do these collections still educate the general public on maybe how they could go about? Because I think so many people are really scared of picking anything that looks like a mushroom for fear of getting that poisonous one.
Yeah, so these collections really are, they're really important for establishing a baseline of biodiversity. And we lack that baseline for fungi. We largely have that baseline for plants and most animals, save perhaps some of the insects and relatives. Airplane, sorry.
That's okay. I can't even hear it. Can you, Katie?
Oh, right.
Yeah, we're okay.
Well, you're about to hear it. I think it's about to get closer. Yeah, I'm pretty close to the airport here. Right. So there's not like any, you know, there's no direct relationship to the general public with these collections, but they serve as documentation of the existence of an organism at a particular place at a particular time. And that information is really important for understanding how things change in the future. So without that baseline documentation, we wouldn't know, for example, if a fungus has moved its range or has gone up in elevation or is gone extinct. So that's the kind of information that if we want to know those things, and I think we do because they're so important to our ecosystems, that we need this basic documentation to be able to observe those changes.
Before we let you go, I just have to know about the humongous fungus that is in the Malheur National Forest in eastern Oregon. It's thought to be, this is the first time I've ever heard of this, an individual organism covering 2,300 acres. Wow. How do you do research on that?
Yeah, so it is believed to be the largest single individual organism in the world. You can fit 30 pandos inside of it. So I know everybody's proud of Pando, the large aspen clone, but this certainly exceeds the size of Pando quite substantially. So it is very difficult to do research on this. You have to go and find the fungus. It happens to be a tree pathogen. And so you can find diseased trees. And so once you find the diseased tree, you can peel back the bark and find the fungus growing underneath the bark, and then you can sample it. So this is a fungus that you can grow fairly easily in a laboratory. And in fact, my lab has done research on this one individual fungus, and we have it growing in our lab. And one of my former students, in fact, was able to get it to produce mushrooms, which no one's ever seen the mushrooms from this individual before. And we were able to produce these mushrooms in our lab at the University of Utah.
That's kind of crazy. How did the student do it?
It took a long time. And in fact, the mushrooms appeared months after we had intended them to appear. We just kind of left the jar that we were growing them in. We left it in the incubator for months and months and then opened up the door one day and there they were. So it was intentional but unintentional at the same time. And we used a kind of a weird combination of ingredients that included orange peels and tomatoes. Don't ask me why that seems to work, but it does.
So you've been doing this you've been publishing papers since 2003. That's a long time to be studying fungi. In those 20 years, what has been the biggest surprise that you think you've found in your studies?
Oh boy, I can't tell you what I like the most, but I'm not sure what's the biggest
surprise. Like the most about the fungi that you've discovered and studied over the years?
I like the fact that I never know what I'm going to find, and I always find something I don't know.
Oh, that is a great answer. I love that. Dr. Bren Dentinger is our guest. He is the curator of mycology at the Natural History Museum of Utah, also a professor in the biology department at the University of Utah. And he also has a great site that it's called dentingerlab.org. That's D-E-N-T-I-N-G-E-R, lab.org, where you have all of your research. And this lab, I suppose, is just, it travels with you wherever you go, or do you have an actual physical site that's in the Natural History Museum or at the university?
Yeah, it's a physical lab space at the Natural History Museum of Utah. It's a genetics lab, so we work on museum genetics, almost exclusively fungi in my case, of course. And then we also have a lab space at the University of Utah to do more of our culturing work, where we grow different fungi for various projects.
Well, that is great. Well, thank you so much for joining us. This is a fascinating topic, and maybe you could leave us with the one thing that you wish that people were more aware of regarding fungi, including how to maybe pronounce it correctly.
I would really like people to appreciate just how important these organisms are to our everyday lives and our future. They really support many of the things that we take for granted when we look outside, and I think that has been missing from the conversation. So I hope people can appreciate them more.
Great. Thank you, Bren.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Katie Mullally.
One of the most powerful questions humans ask about the cosmos is, of course, are we alone? While the science behind this inquiry is fascinating, it doesn't exist in a vacuum, according to our next guest. It's a reflection of our values, our fears, and most importantly, our enduring sense of hope. In her new book, The Possibility of Life, acclaimed science journalist Jamie Green traces the history of our understanding from the days of Galileo and Copernicus to our contemporary quest for exoplanets. And she joins us now to explore this conversation. Jamie Green, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Well, we were just talking about whether or not we were Trekkies or not growing up. Both you and Katie were. I have to say that I fought with my brother because to me, he was a Trekkie. He would want to watch it after school. I thought it was ridiculous because this couldn't exist. I now think he was of much higher mind because he would say it's a metaphor for who we are, you know, as a kid.
Yeah. Wow. He could have written this book.
And so yeah, that's maybe where you should start, because it's really the premise of your book, of how we look at the cosmos is really a reflection or a mirror of ourselves.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, in the book, I write about science and science fiction. And I think both of those really show, we use them as reflections of ourselves, and we use them as ways to test out different possibilities. And I feel like Star Trek is a huge example of this. It's a big, what if there was no more war? What if poverty had been eradicated? You know, it's a really pacifist, socialist, hopeful view of the future. And I think it was meant to be inspiring to say like, this could be the future if you want it to be the future. And all of the different aliens are different kinds of people, you know, and they really on Star Trek fall into at least the original few species really fall into, you know, categories. You know, the Klingons are warlike, Vulcans are logical. They're humanity taken to different extremes. And they're just ways of understanding, like, what would it be like if we followed logic instead of emotion? What would it be like if we followed only our passions instead of, you know, exerting what we think of as self-control?
I just love that. And then also what you talk about in the book, I've seen programs on this before, how, you know, if we were just presented with the facts about the cosmos, like the science behind what we have found out there, we would never understand it because it would be handed to us by an astrophysicist in a math formula. But really there is so much creativity from the art world, for example, that really brings us something that we otherwise couldn't have any knowledge of unless we were also astrophysicists, right?
Yeah. In the chapter in the book about planets, I talked to a couple of artists who work for NASA, for JPL, doing illustrations of exoplanets. And these illustrations, you know, go along with press releases. They're the images that you often see accompanying news stories about a new planet might have water on it. It was detected. But what we know about it is so limited. We know its size. We know either its mass or its radius, or maybe sometimes we know both, and we know how close it is to its star, so we know how much sunlight it gets. And from just those few bits of data, scientists are able to extrapolate a lot. From the density of the planet, they can figure out, is it rocky, is it gaseous, how much atmosphere might it have if it has an atmosphere. You could probably figure out, you know, okay, if we assume that it's composed like Earth, what would the gravity be on the surface, you know, things like that. And then when you know how close it is to its star, you can start making inferences about the climate, you know, if it has an atmosphere, how warm would it be, how cold would it be, would there be liquid water? But then from there, the artists have to make choices to make these illustrations. And the illustrations are often what is so compelling to the reader of the newspaper or the magazine who sees this article, because, you know, if you tell me a planet is 1.5 times the size of the Earth, okay, I don't know what to do with that. But if you show me a planet, maybe with rivers, maybe with clouds, maybe with rocks, I can imagine it, and it becomes so much more meaningful. And the science becomes so much more exciting because it's not about finding data points, it's about finding other worlds.
Well, the premise of your book, of course, is the possibility of life.
Yeah.
Kind of going back to Star Trek, you referenced that silicon-based creature that lived in the rocks, Horta.
Yeah.
That really challenged their perception of what life is, but can we modern day truly define life?
No, we can't. And it's actually a really interesting question, because something I touch on in the book and have dug into more is, you know, there's all this stress about we don't have a definition of life. If we define it by, you know, consuming fuel for energy, then is a fire alive? Or if we talk about reproduction, is a mule or my grandmother alive? You know, it's really, really hard. And there's a school of thought that it's because defining life is totally misguided, because life isn't a concept like, you know, it's not a human-made concept, you know, like how do you define a teacher or a bachelor? It's a fundamental of the universe, like water. And we were only able to understand what water was once we had a scientific theory of molecules and compounds. And so similarly, there's some really interesting work being done trying to come up with a theory of life that would be like a physics explanation of what happens when we move into biology, like what is the universe doing and how can we understand that as a natural phenomenon?
Well, and you're right. And one of the elements that we look to for life is our own DNA, the DNA that we find across all life on the planet. I don't have any background in biology, but do we limit ourselves with just the DNA structure? Can there be multiple, you know, let's go to the basis of DNA. Can there be multiple structures of DNA to create life?
There's no concrete reason why DNA would have to look like this. So if we think that life on another world, I mean, it has to encode information somehow, right? Like you need instructions for building such complex things as life. DNA seems to work really well on Earth, but, you know, DNA and even RNA use different bases. Similarly, our proteins use some amino acids, but not all of them. Other life could use different chemical building blocks. So it doesn't have to be as radical as replacing carbon with silicon, like in that episode of Star Trek. It could be other small changes. But, you know, when we're searching for life, we really get stuck between this idea of, are we being too closed-minded? Maybe life doesn't need liquid water. Maybe life wouldn't use DNA or proteins. Who knows? But then also we have to start somewhere, and we only have one example of life, and it's this one. And so like the space to search is so vast, both in physical space and in the like metaphorical chemical space, you know, all the possibilities that we could be looking for. It's like we've barely scratched the surface. So some people argue, let's start with what we know works and check that out first.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're speaking with science journalist Jamie Green about her new book, The Possibility of Life. Jamie, I'd love to go back in history to the, you know, the first astronomers or the first scientists or even the first philosophers who said, hey, wait a minute, we can't be, it doesn't make sense that we're the only living intelligent beings out there. Who was that?
It's really hard to pin down who the first was, because also when you think about, you know, what other beings might be out there, does that include angels? Does that include spirits? Does that include, you know, a sense of your ancestors being wherever they might be that is somewhere else? You know, humans have always, as far, you know, as far back as we can tell, thought about other beings, whether that's, you know, gods or ghosts or spirits or whatever it is. And so it really depends on like the culture that you're living in. You know, Buddhism conceives of multiple worlds. You know, there's the world that we live in, there's the world of the hungry ghosts, there's the world of enlightened beings. And so that is, but those are physical worlds that are thought to exist somewhere, just like heaven and hell are sometimes thought to be physical worlds. But if you think about it, to whatever extent you can separate it from spirituality, one of the earliest examples that I saw is the Greek atomists. Who, you know, that's where you get the origin of the word atom. This was a school of philosophy that believed that matter at its smallest was made of particles. They didn't know what they were. And they thought that there was so much matter in the universe that there had to be other worlds and it had to be infinite. But the reigning school of thought, the, you know, it was Aristotle. And Aristotle believed that the Earth was the center of the solar system and the solar system was the center of the universe. And that was it. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until Galileo that in the West, we knew that the planets that we saw in the sky, that were little dots in the sky that looked like stars, but didn't twinkle and didn't move with the whole celestial sphere. It wasn't until Galileo that we knew that those were spheres, that they were worlds, because it required telescopes and being able to see, I think it was that Venus had phases like the moon, which meant that it was a sphere, you know, getting different sunlight on different parts of it. And that really unlocked the possibilities of imagining, because if you, you know, imagination does go beyond what we know with science. But if you don't even have the possibility, if a world is just one, if the Earth is the only world, you know, there were stories about beings on the sun or on the moon. Those weren't quite as rooted in possibility as once we discovered that there were other planets. And if they were planets, like the Earth was a planet, and they were, you know, logically made up of the same stuff, why wouldn't they also have life? It all of a sudden was a very, very short leap.
Yeah, I can imagine that. So Galileo gave us that possibility to begin with, and, you know, for which he was chastised, you know, to a certain degree, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so jump from there to who gave us the art? So who gave us it? I mean, it's very sort of self-centered to make an alien look like a humanoid, but just green with a big head, right? Where was that first conjured?
I mean, the first alien stories, you know, followed pretty quickly after Galileo in, you know, the Renaissance and sort of those, that handful of centuries a while ago. Science and fiction writing weren't that separate. You know, one of the early, you could call it science fiction stories that I write about is written by Johannes Kepler, who's one of the most important scientists in figuring out how the solar system works. He's the one who figured out that orbits are ellipses instead of circles. Like, very important scientist. Also wrote this book called Somnium about a man who has a dream and finds out about what life is like on the moon. You know, like it was not separate. It was all intertwined. And in those imaginings, the men on the moon were a lot like people. They were called men. They were bigger or they had different culture, but they were just humans because that was what was imagined. I think it was probably Darwin's work that opened up the possibilities of thinking about life taking different forms, following different paths. And really in the 20th centuries, when you start seeing people imagining, okay, what if the dominant intelligent life form didn't evolve from apes as we did, but evolved from bugs or evolved from lizards? So you get bug men and lizard men and all that sort of stuff. You know, the monster, the aliens in the War of the Worlds are pretty monstrous. They're not walking around looking like people. But there are also scientific arguments for aliens possibly looking humanoid. You know, we don't know for sure, but there was a scientist in, I think, the 1980s who did a sort of thought experiment thinking about, okay, if the dinosaurs had never gone extinct and they had evolved intelligence, what would, instead of a humanoid, a dinosauroid look like? And so he's thinking, okay, well, they would need to walk upright. I don't quite remember why, but he had an evolutionary reason. And okay, if you're walking upright, you probably want to be on two legs because, you know, that's how dinosaurs were working. Oh, it's because you need your hands for manipulation, right? You want your hands for tools. So you're walking, and once you're walking upright, you need like strong muscles to propel you. So you end up with a butt. And if you want to be able to communicate vocally, your head becomes upright. Your head is bigger to hold a brain. Your hands can do fine work, and all of a sudden you get just like a scaly person. It's very easy to say, you know, okay, the eyes need to be forwards because you're coming from carnivores, et cetera, et cetera. And you can follow evolutionary logic to argue that a humanoid shape is ideal. But it's really hard to separate that from the fact that we know the humanoid shape. This is the only example that we have. And so thinking about the requirements for an intelligent alien's physiology, it's sort of like trying to think outside of your own language, you know? It's just what's there, and it's and that is where really interesting work happens in science fiction, really trying to break out of those constraints and imagine something truly, truly different.
One of the things I love to think about when I'm watching a science fiction movie, especially when they have interesting creatures, it's like, why would that have evolved? Why does that creature have six legs or those tentacles or those colors? And like you said, we keep ourselves trapped in our evolutionary mindset. So that's what other metrics can scientists or are scientists using to think about the evolution, or even do they call it evolution, of potential life forms?
I think they would call it evolution, but it's not, once you get past like the origin of life and single-celled organisms, it's not something that scientists are doing a lot of work about. Like when I was getting scientists to talk to me about alien animals, I had to really be like, all right, come on, keep imagining. It's not something that they're writing, you know, journal articles about, because it requires so much extrapolation. You know, if you think about every step from the origin of life to us getting here as like, it could have gone any number of ways and it happened to go this way. By the time you get to something like animals, that requires so many of those branching paths to follow the same series of paths that we took. Even the idea that another world would have something like animals. It would have plants and animals and fungi. Like, there's no reason that has to happen, unless it turns out that that is a really advantageous way for life to evolve and it works really well and life just kind of clicks into those patterns. Just like on Earth, we see, you know, organs and shapes and kinds of animals that have evolved independently multiple times. You know, human eyes and octopus eyes have very similar anatomy but evolved totally separately. Plants have evolved the ability to make caffeine something like three or four separate times. Dolphins and sharks, totally unrelated unless you go very, very, very far back. And so that's the idea of convergent evolution. And it's a really big question whether evolution is primarily convergent, that it tends to come up with the same ideal solutions to problems over and over and over again, or if those are just flukes and evolution is really random and just depends on, you know, did the asteroid fall 10 feet to the left or 10 feet to the right? And who did it smush and who survived? And okay, then you get a totally different world. It's not just the big extinctions. There's so many moments where this animal got gobbled up and that animal didn't. And so that animal was your great, 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 great grandmother.
One of the measurements that you talk about in defining life is intelligence, you know, and especially advanced life that we think might come to Earth someday. But how would we even be able to measure that or notice it when we can't even understand intelligence of an octopus or a dolphin? I mean, how will we know intelligence when we see it?
That's a really good question. And it really depends on how similar that intelligence is to ours, or if it's like super, super advanced and it has figured out how to communicate with any kind of intelligence, which is often something that sci-fi does. Like, don't worry. They have universal translators. There are often at science conferences that are talking about SETI, about the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. You know, on a panel, there will be an anthropologist or a dolphin researcher who will say something like, guys, we do not have a great track record with intelligence on Earth. What makes us other humans? You know, there's a lot of not good stuff about how we've treated other intelligent animals and other different kinds of people. So what do we think is going to go so well with aliens? And that is, so that's a conversation within the scientific community too. Something, you know, I did some research on dolphin research and dolphin intelligence when I was writing the book, and I was really surprised how little we actually know about dolphins. You know, I came into it thinking that we have a pretty good understanding of their squeaks and clicks. There is just one kind of dolphin call that has been definitively identified, and that's their sort of their name calls. Every dolphin has a name, basically. But even just as an example of how differently their minds work, if a dolphin mother is looking for her baby dolphin who's swimming around, she says her own name. So instead of calling for the baby, it's like if I'm looking for my son, I'd be walking around going, Jamie, it's like you're identifying yourself. You're like, I'm here, which is just so different if you think about it. Or like dolphins don't have object permanence. If you put an object in a bucket that they can't echolocate through, they have no idea where, and then you move the bucket, they can't find the object. And that's something that seems so fundamental to humans, but isn't relevant in dolphin life. There are not opaque buckets in the ocean. So in different environments, even on Earth, intelligence evolves so differently and communication evolves so differently. On the flip side, if we think about life on another planet being analogous to life on Earth, then maybe the aliens there live on land like we do, are omnivorous like we are social like we are, speak with vocal language or hand signals like humans do. In that case, coming from such a similar environment and a similar evolutionary legacy, there's reason to think their intelligence could be more like ours than dolphins, even though dolphins live on Earth and have a relatively recent common lineage with us. But because their environment is so different and the evolutionary challenges that they've had to overcome are so different, they've evolved into a really different way. So an alien who lives like us, you know, might be more similar to us than a dolphin. It might be, but then, you know, we think about trying to communicate even with chimpanzees, and that is very tricky as well.
This is just so fascinating. And I know you've met already a lot of critical acclaim for this book. It's really helping people, you know, take on a different view of what's going on, what might be going on out there. And I'm wondering what ultimately is your hope for your audience with this book?
I think one of my hopes is just, not that it's like trying to sneak in medicine with a spoonful of sugar, but there's a lot of science that I learned while writing this book that I think is really cool. Stuff about the origin of life and exoplanets and new ways of thinking about artificial intelligence, which is extremely relevant right now, you know? And so there's a lot of cool science in it that I hope people will enjoy. But what I found writing this book and that I hope is shared by readers, what I discovered writing this book and that I hope readers can find also, is in thinking about all the life that could be on other planets, you know, in order to do that, we have to think really deeply about the life that's on our planet. And so thinking about dolphin intelligence, thinking about, you know, all the different kinds of animals and the origin of life and just all the luck that brought us here, all the flukes, all the, you know, that fish got gobbled up, this fish is my great, 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 great grandmother. It made me appreciate life on Earth more. I've always been a space person, an astronomy person. I feel like writing this book almost turned me into a biology person. I'm like, I look at the birds in my backyard. I'm like, that is amazing. There are birds, you know, stuff that I never really thought about before. Or just, you know, thinking about the cells in my body and the intensely complicated series of molecules that create energy in our bodies that turn, you know, food. It's just like, that's amazing. And, you know, I took high school biology, I learned the Krebs cycle, but I feel like by connecting it to this search for meaning and this search for kinship, to quote the subtitle of my book, this search for kinship in the cosmos, we don't know what's out there, but we do know what's here. And there's a lot of amazing life right here on Earth. And that has gotten more exciting to me the more that I've thought about what life might be elsewhere too.
Oh, I just love it. What a great book. And it really, this last answer you gave, it really takes us back to the beginning, which is the fact that all these things that you're thinking now and that made you realize to a deeper degree is it all kind of stems from your original interest in being a Trekkie.
Yeah.
I love it. And so I feel like there's hope for me now. I can go back with your book and rediscover that the true meaning of being Trekkie or of Star Trek. Well, the book is The Possibility of Life. Our guest is science journalist Jamie Green. Jamie, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for tuning into Cool Science Radio here on KPCW 91.7 in Park City, Utah. And don't forget to go to kpcw.org under the Shows tab to listen to past episodes and get links to our podcast. And then tune in next week. We'll be talking with Phil Pliatt, an astronomer who's written a great book about under alien skies, who will be the guest at the Clark Planetarium's 20th anniversary.